Chapter 3. Harness rooms and coach house. The state carriages, with their carved and gilt wheels, their panels gay with flush divinities, and their stupendous velvet hammer cloths etched with bullion, held Dodo spellbound. He had a born taste for splendor, and the thought that he might one day sit in one of these glittering vehicles puffed his breast with pride, and made him address the hunchback with sudden condescension. When I'm a man I shall ride in these carriages, he said, whereat the other laughed and returned good-humoredly, that's not so much to boast of, Cavalier. I shall ride in a carriage one of these days myself. Odo stared, not over-pleased, and the boy added, when I'm carried to the churchyard, with a chuckle of relish at the joke. From the stables they passed to the riding school, with its open galleries supported on twisted columns, where the Duke's gentlemen managed their horses, and took their exercise in bad weather. Several rode there that morning, and among them, on a fine Arab, Odo recognized the young man in black velvet who was so often in Donna Laura's apartments. "Who's that?" he whispered, pulling the hunchback's sleeve, as the gentleman, just below them, made his horse execute a brilliant ballotade. "That? Bless the innocent. Why, the Count Lelio Tresker, your illustrious mother's cavalier servant." Odo was puzzled, but some instinct of reserve withheld him from further questions. The hunchback, however, had no such scruples. "They do say, though," he went on, "that her highness has her eye on him, and in that case I'll wager your illustrious mama has no more chance than a sparrow against a hawk." The boy's words were incomprehensible, but the vague sense that some danger might be threatening his mother's friend made Odo whisper, "What would her highness do to him?" "Make him a prime minister, Cavalier," the hunchback laughed. Odo's guide, it appeared, was not privileged to conduct him through the state apartments of the palace, and the little boy had now been 4 days under the ducal roof without catching so much as a glimpse of his sovereign and cousin. The very next morning, however, Vanna swept him from his trundle bed with the announcement that he was to be received by the Duke that day, and that the tailor was now waiting to try on his court dress. He found his mother propped against her pillows, drinking chocolate, feeding her pet monkey and giving agitated directions to the maidservants on their knees before the open carriage trunks. Her Excellency informed Odo that as he at that moment received an express from his grandfather, the old Marquess di Donnas, that they were to start next morning for the castle of Donnas, and that he was to be presented to the Duke as soon as his highness had risen from dinner. A plump purse lay on the coverlet, and her countenance wore an air of kindness and animation which, together with the prospect of wearing a court dress and traveling to his grandfather's castle in the mountains, so worked on Odo's spirits that, forgetting the abate's instructions, he sprang to her with an eager caress. "Child, child," was her only rebuke, and she added, with a tap on his cheek, "It is lucky I shall have a sword to protect me." Long before the hour Odo was buttoned into his embroidered coat and waistcoat. He would have on the sword at once, and when they sat down to dinner, though his mother pressed him to eat with more concern than she had before shown, it went hard with him to put his weapon aside, and he cast longing eyes at the corner where it lay. At length a chamberlain summoned them, and they set out down the corridors, attended by two servants. Odo held his head high, with one hand leading Donna Laura, for he would not appear to be led by her, while the other fingered his sword. The deformed beggars who always lurked about the great staircase fawned on them as they passed, and on a landing they crossed the humpbacked boy, who grinned mockingly at Odo, but the latter, with his chin up, would not so much as glance at him. A master of ceremonies in short black cloak and gold chain received them in the antechamber of the Duchess's apartments, where the court played lansquenet after dinner. The doors of Her Highness's closet were thrown open, and Odo, now glad enough to cling to his mother's hand, found himself in a tall room, with gods and goddesses in the clouds overhead, and personages as supraterrestrial seated in gilt armchairs about a smoking brazier. Before one of these, to whom Donalorus wept successive curtsies in advancing, the frightened cavalier found himself dragged with his sword between his legs. He ducked his head like the old drake diving for worms in the puddle at the farm, and when at last he dared look up, it was to see an odd sallow face, half smothered in an immense wig, bowing back at him with infinite ceremony, and Odo's heart sank to think that this was his sovereign. The Duke was in fact a sickly narrow-faced young man with thick obstinate lips and a slight lameness that made his walk ungainly. But though no way resembling the ermine-cloaked king of the chapel at Pontesordo, he yet knew how to put on a certain majesty with his state wig and his orders. As for the newly married duchess, who sat at the other end of the cabinet caressing a toy spaniel, she was scant 14, and looked a mere child in her great hoop and jeweled stomacher. Her wonderful fair hair, drawn over a cushion and lightly powdered, was twisted with pearls and roses, and her cheeks excessively rouged, in the French fashion, so that as she arose on the approach of the visitors she looked to Odo for all the world like a wooden virgin hung with votive offerings, in the parish church at Pontesordo. Though they were but 3 months married, the Duke, it was rumored, was never with her, preferring the company of the young Marquess of Cerveno, his cousin and heir presumptive, a pale boy scented with musk and painted like a comedian, whom his highness would never suffer away from him, and who now leaned with an impertinent air against the back of the ducal armchair. On the other side of the brazier sat the Dowager Duchess, the Duke's grandmother, an old lady so high and forbidding of aspect that Odo cast but one look at her face, which was yellow and wrinkled as a medlar, and surmounted, in the Spanish style, with black veils and a high coif. What these alarming personages said and did, the child could never recall, nor were his own actions clear to him, except for a furtive caress that he remembered giving the spaniel as he kissed the Duchess's hand, whereupon Her Highness snatched up the pampered animal and walked away with a pout of anger. Odo noticed that her angry look followed him as he and Donalora withdrew, but the next moment he heard the Duke's voice and saw His Highness limping after them. "You must have a furred cloak for your journey, cousin," said he awkwardly, pressing something in the hand of Odo's mother, who broke into fresh compliments and curtsies, while the Duke, with a finger on his thick lip, withdrew hastily into the closet. The next morning early they set out on their journey. There had been frost in the night, and a cold sun sparkled on the palace windows and on the marble church fronts as their carriage lumbered through the streets, now full of noise and animation. It was Odo's first glimpse of the town by daylight, and he clapped his hands with delight at sight of the people picking their way across the reeking gutters, the asses laden with milk and vegetables, the servant girls bargaining at the provision stalls, the shopkeepers' wives going to mass in pattens and hoods, with scaldani in their muffs, the dark recessed openings in the palace basements, where fruit sellers, wine merchants and coppersmiths displayed their wares, the peddlers hawking books and toys, and here and there a gentleman in a sedan chair returning flushed and disordered from a night at Bassiter Faro. The traveling carriage was escorted by half a dozen of the Duke's troopers, and Don Lelio rode at the door followed by two grooms. He wore a furred coat and boots, and never, to Odo, had he appeared more proud and splendid. But Donna Laura had hardly a word for him, and he rode with the set air of a man who acquits himself of a troublesome duty. Outside the gates the spectacle seemed tame in comparison, for the road bent toward Pontesordo, and Odo was familiar enough with the look of the bare fields, set here and there with oak copses to which the leaves still clung. As the carriage skirted the marsh his mother raised the windows, exclaiming that they must not expose themselves to the pestilent air, and though Odo was not yet addicted to general reflections, he could not but wonder that she should display such dread of an atmosphere as he had let him breathe since his birth. He knew, of course, that the sunset vapors on the marsh were unhealthy. Everybody on the farm had a touch of the ague, and it was a saying in the village that no one lived at Pontesordo who could buy an ass to carry him away, but that Donna Laura, in skirting the place on a clear morning of frost, should show such fear of infection, gave a sinister emphasis to the ill repute of the region. The thought, he knew not why, turned his mind to Mamola, who often on damp evenings sat shaking and burning in the kitchen corner. He reflected with a pang that he might never see her again, and leaning forward he strained his eyes for a glimpse of Pontesordo. They were passing through a patch of oaks, but where these ended the country opened, and beyond a belt of osiers, and the mottled faded stretches of the marsh the keep stood up like a beckoning finger. Odo cried out, as though in answer to its call, but that moment the road turned a knoll, and bent across rising ground toward an unfamiliar region. "Thank God!" cried his mother, lowering the window, "we're rid of that poison, and can breath the air." As the keep vanished, Odo reproached himself for not having begged a pair of shoes for Mamola. He had felt very sorry for her since the hunchback had spoken so strangely of life at the foundling hospital, and he had a sudden vision of her bare feet, pinched with cold and cut with the pebbles of the yard, perpetually running across the damp stone floors, with Philomena crying after her, "Hasten then, child of iniquity. You are slower than a day without bread." He had almost resolved to speak of the foundling to his mother, who still seemed in a condescending humor, but his attention was unexpectedly distracted by a troop of Egyptians, who came along the road leading a dancing bear, and hardly had these passed, when the chariot of an itinerant dentist engaged him. The whole way, indeed, was alive with such surprises. And at Valseca, where they dined, they found the yard of the inn crowded with the sumpter mules and servants of a cardinal traveling to Rome, who was to lie there that night, and whose bedstead and saucepans had preceded him. Here, after dinner, Don Lelio took leave of Odo's mother, with small show of regret on either side, the lady high and sarcastic, the gentleman sullen and polite, and both, as it seemed, easier when the business was dispatched, and the Count's foot in the stirrup. He had so far taken little notice of Odo, but he now bent from the saddle, and tapped the boy's cheek, saying in his cold way, "In a few years I shall see you at court," and with that rode away toward Pianura. 1.4. Lying that night at Pavia, the travelers set forward next morning for the city of Vercelli. The road, though it ran for the most part through flat mulberry orchards, and rice fields reflecting the pale blue sky in their sodden channels, would yet have appeared diverting enough to Odo, had his mother been in the mood, to reply to his questions. For whether their carriage overtook a party of strolling jugglers, traveling in a roofed-in wagon, with the younger children of the company running alongside in threadbare tights and trunks decked with tinsel, or whether they drove through a village marketplace, where yellow earthen crocks and gaudy Indian cottons, brass pails and braziers and platters of bluish pewter, filled the stalls with a medley of color at every turn, was something that excited the boy's wonder. But Donna Laura, who had fallen into a depression of spirits, lamenting the cold, her misfortunes and the discomfort of the journey, was at no more pains than the abate, to satisfy the promptings of his curiosity. Odo had indeed met but one person who cared to listen to him, and that was the strange hunchback who had called himself Brutus. Remembering how entertainingly this odd guide had explained all the wonders of the Ducal grounds, Odo began to regret that he had not asked his mother to let him have Brutus for a body servant. Meanwhile, no one attended to his questions, and the hours were beginning to seem long when, on the third day, they set out from Vercelli toward the hills. The cold increased as they rose, and Odo, though he had often wished to see the mountains, was yet dismayed at the gloomy and menacing aspect of the region on which they were entering. Leafless woods, prodigious boulders and white torrents foaming and roaring seemed a poor exchange for the pleasantly ordered gardens of Pianura. Here were no violets and cowslips in bloom, hardly a green blade pierced the sodden roadside, and snowdrifts lingered in the shaded hollows. Donna Laura's loudly expressed fear of robbers seemed to increase the loneliness of the way, which now traversed tracts of naked moorland, now plunged again into forest, with no sign of habitation, but here and there a cowherd's hut under the trees, or a chapel standing apart on some grassy eminence. When night fell, the waters grew louder, a stinging wind swept the woods, and the carriage, staggering from rut to rut, seemed every moment about to land them in some invisible ravine. Fear and cold at last, Benham the little boy, and when he woke he was being lifted from his seat, and torches were flashing on a high escutcheon doorway set in battlemented walls. He was carried into a hall lit with smoky oil lamps, and hung with armor and torn banners. Here, among a group of rough-looking servants, a tall old man in a nightcap and furred gown was giving orders in a loud, passionate voice. This personage, who was of a chivalric complexion, with a face like mottled red marble, seized Dodo by the wrist, and led him up a flight of stairs so worn and slippery that he tripped at every step, thence down a corridor and into a gloomy apartment, where three ladies shivered about a table set with candles. Bidden by the old gentleman to salute his grandmother and great-aunts, Odo bowed over three wrinkled hands, one fat and soft as a toad's stomach, the others yellow and dry as lemon skins. His mother embraced the ladies in the same humble manner, and the Marquess, first furiously calling for supper, thrust Odo down on the stool in the ingle. From this point of observation the child, now vividly awake, noted the hangings of faded tapestry that heaved in the draught, the ceiling of beams and the stone floor strewn with rushes. The candlelight flickering on the faces of his aged relatives showed his grandmother to be a pale, heavy-cheeked person with little watchful black eyes which she dropped at her husband's approach, while the two great aunts, seated side by side in high-backed chairs with their feet on braziers, reminded Odo of the narrow elongated saints squeezed into the niches of a church door. The old marchioness wore the high coif and veil of the previous century. The aunts, who, as Odo afterwards learned, were canonesses of a noble order, were habited in a semi-conventual dress, with crosses hanging on their bosoms, and none spoke, but when the Marquess addressed them. Their timidity appeared to infect Odo's mother, who, from her habitual volubility of temper, sank to a mood of like submissiveness. A supper of venison and goat's cheese was not designed to restore her spirits, and when at length she and Odo had withdrawn to their cavernous bedchamber, she flung herself weeping on the bed and declared she must die if she remained long in this prison. Falling asleep under such influences, it was the more wonderful to Odo to wake with the sun on his counterpane, a sweet noise of streams through the casement, and the joyous barking of hounds in the castle court. From the window seat he looked out on a scene extraordinarily novel to his lowland eyes. The chamber commanded the wooded steep below the castle, with a stream looping its base. Beyond, the pasture sloped pleasantly under walnut trees, with here and there a clearing plowed for the spring crops, and a sunny ledge or two planted with vines. Above this pastoral landscape, bare crags upheld a snow peak, and, as if to lend a human interest to the scene, the old Marquess, his flintlock on his shoulder, his dogs and beaters at his heels, now rode across the valley. Wonder succeeded to wonder that first morning, for there was the castle to be seen, with the kennels and stables roughly kept, but full of dogs and horses, and Odo, in the Marquess's absence, was left free to visit every nook of his new home. Pontesordo, though perhaps as ancient as Donnes, was but a fortified manor in the plain. But here was the turreted border castle, bristling at the head of the gorge like the fangs in a boar's throat. Its walls overhung by machicolations, its portcullis still dropped at nightfall, and the loud stream forming a natural moat at its base. Through the desert spaces of this great structure Odo wandered at will, losing himself in its network of bare chambers, some now put to domestic uses, with smoked meats hanging from the rafters, cheeses ranged on shelves and farmers' implements stacked on the floor. Others abandoned to bats and spiders, with slit-like openings choked by a growth of wild cherries, and little animals scurrying into their holes as Odo opened the unused doors. At the next turn he mounted by a winding stair to the platform behind the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.